If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang in there.
Because,
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
MSW Media.
They might be giants have been on the road for too long.
Too long.
And they might be giants aren't even sorry.
Not even sorry.
And audiences like the shows too much.
Too much.
And now they might be giants are playing their breakthrough album, Flood.
All of it.
And they still have time for other songs.
They're fooling around.
Who can stop They Might Be Giants and their liberal rock agenda?
Who?
No one.
This ad was paid for with somebody else's money.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, one rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hey everybody, it is Wednesday, March 10th, and this is episode 8 of Clean Up on Aisle 45. I'm Andrew Torres.
And I'm Allison Gill, AG.
And we have a really exciting show for you today. We have a fantastic interview with one of my favorite people, Asha Rangappa, who's going to break down everything that's going on in connection with investigations regarding January 6th and, you know, whether there are dots to be connected between insurrectionists and the Trump administration.
Mm, yeah.
And a whole bunch else besides. So I'm very, very excited about that.
Yeah. Yeah. She's always a treat to talk to. In fact, you and I were live in Philadelphia with Asha Rangappa when we did our Mueller She Wrote show there in Philly. So that was a blast.
Oh, that was so much fun.
Oh, yeah. We went out, had wine and fries after. It was great. It was a great time. Good time to be alive. Can't wait to get back out on the road. All right, let's dive in here. We're going to start the show talking today. It's a story that's on everyone's minds as we are recording this. It's the trial of Officer Derek Chauvin, who was charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter in connection with the brutal killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And today, we learned that jury selection has been delayed as the parties debate over whether it's permissible for the state to add a separate charge of third-degree murder. Andrew, before we kind of break this all down and talk about what's going on, what's the difference between second and third degree murder in Minnesota? We had each covered this separately, I know, on our shows, Opening Arguments and Daily Beans, but this was a while ago, so let's do a refresher.
Yeah, and these are atypical murder statutes. So first degree murder, premeditated murder, that's the same every state. Right. And proving premeditation is really, really hard. Right. That is lying in wait with a sniper rifle, for example. Right. Second degree murder is defined as following. Right. Whoever causes the death of a human being with intent to effect the death of that person or another, but without premeditation. Right. So in other words, you don't have to prove I planned this in advance. You do have to prove I intended to kill the person that I killed.
Mm.
Contrast that with murder in the third degree, which in Minnesota, see if you can spot kind of the idiosyncrasies in this law. It says, whoever, without intent to effect the death of any person, causes the death of another by perpetrating an act eminently dangerous to others, put a pin in that, and evincing a depraved mind without regard for human life, is guilty of murder in the third degree. Right. So you see, like, the Venn diagram of these two, right? Like, it does not completely encompass the universe of conduct, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, depraved mind, first of all, is an interesting concept. Yeah. And the dangerous, did the act dangerous to others? Okay. But maybe not the, yeah. And then, of course, how does involuntary manslaughter work its way in if third degree murder is causing the death by perpetrating an act eminently dangerous to others without regard for human life, but is kind of an accident? It seems odd. It's just an odd wording. And I think, is that what you kind of mean by these are unusual statutes?
Yeah. And I mean, the key sort of word that's unusual in that third degree murder statute is the word others. Right. And here's an example of like just where lawyers screw things up. Under Minnesota law, for as long as courts have been analyzing that third degree murder statute until a month ago, courts have interpreted that word others to mean that your eminently dangerous act must apply to more than one person. Right. Like,
well, so, I mean, wasn't he originally charged with both second and third degree murder? And I mean, if this, like you said, this kind of comes down mm-hmm. to proof. I mean, if you're a prosecutor in front of a jury, you don't want to be left with nothing but a manslaughter charge if they're convinced that Chauvin didn't intend to cause the death of George Floyd. And, as you and I know from the Mueller investigation, intent, as you said a minute ago, is really hard to prove. But he was charged with both of these. And then we had already talked about, I think actually I spoke with you about this, and I know I spoke with Ellie Honig about it, yeah, is that you can bring second degree murder charges and the jury may find that it didn't reach second degree and come back with a third degree charge. So it seems odd to me.
Yeah, it was odd, right? And what made this situation particularly odd is that the usual case in which you charge both second and third degree murder under Minnesota law is something like firing wildly with a semi-automatic weapon or throwing a Molotov cocktail at a group of folks, right?
Okay.
And this really is where kind of the procedural geekery comes in. Courts had uniformly interpreted that others, right, with the S, to mean that third degree murder could only be sustained if that eminently dangerous act was capable of harming more than one person. And kneeling on one person's neck is dangerous exactly to one person. So what happened was Chauvin's lawyers moved to dismiss all the charges against him for lack of probable cause. Now, this is a totally routine thing that defense lawyers do and that the court just denies, right? Like that just happens. But here the trial judge looked at it and said, yeah, based on the case law, I'm going to deny the motion with respect to everything else, but grant it with respect to the third degree murder charge because Chauvin, under the allegations, only could potentially have caused the death of one person and not others, plural.
Okay, so because under the interpretation of Minnesota statute here, the court couldn't sustain a third degree murder charge where violence was directed at a single person and not others.
Right. And so that's where we were set until last month, right? February 1st, the Intermediate Appellate Court in Minnesota, in an entirely separate case called State versus Knorr, upheld a third degree murder conviction of a police officer in a shooting death of a single person in connection with a 9/11 call. And that court, the Minnesota Court of Appeals, explicitly said in its holding that third degree murder can be sustained even if it's directed at a single victim.
Isn't that what second degree is for, though? I mean, so as you might expect, 3 days after that Knorr decision, right, the prosecution moved to reinstate the third degree murder charges against Chauvin. But for some reason, the district court denied that motion.
Yeah. And again, here's where, you know, the civil procedures or criminal procedure sort of comes into play. The district court said, remember, you know, that was decided 5 weeks ago, was on appeal to the state Supreme Court. And in fact, the state Supreme Court granted certiorari on March 1st, right? And so the district court's position was, well, that's not really the law yet until the Minnesota State Supreme Court weighs in, right? So it said, nice try, but, you know, not gonna add the third degree murder charge until the state Supreme Court tells me to. And then the prosecution got to appeal that ruling back up to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And the Minnesota Court of Appeals was like, hey, wait a minute. Like, what are we, chopped liver? Like, I get that our case has been appealed to the state Supreme Court, but until they tell us we're wrong, like, we still think we're right. Like, our decision in Noor is good law unless and until the Supreme Court overrules us. So then they sent it back down to the trial court with the instruction to add the third degree murder charge back in.
Okay, but now the defense is challenging the third degree murder charge.
Yeah. So, and that's for the same argument, right? That, look, this is pending before the state Supreme Court, and it would be a mistake for, this is Chauvin's argument, for this court to allow the third degree murder charge to go forward until the state Supreme Court decides with finality. So what happened today, jury selection was supposed to begin, and the defense came forward with this new argument. They argued it today in open court, and it was a request by Derek Chauvin to stay the proceedings. And at the end of the day, the judge denied it. Right. So as we're recording this Monday night, Chauvin has filed a petition for an emergency stay back to our old friends, the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Right. And we can do it. Andrew was wrong on this show, too, if we have to. But my prediction, I feel very, very confident that the Court of Appeals, having twice said we think Noor is good law, is going to deny that stay. And we're going to get jury selection tomorrow and move ahead with the case.
With the third degree murder charge back in.
With the third degree murder charge in. That's right.
All right. Well, we'll keep following. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, right? I mean, if they've decided that others can be one person twice.
Yep.
You know, but I would say that this is probably also typical behavior of the defendant is to file an emergency stay.
Sure.
With that same Court of Appeals. But I'm with you. My beans are on them denying this as well and having the third degree murder charge stay. So what are the mechanics, just so I understand, how do you prosecute a second and third degree murder case? Do you just prosecute it at the second degree level and then it would allow the jury to come back with a third degree ruling?
Yeah, these are called lesser included offenses. And so basically, as a prosecutor, you are saying, I think the evidence shows, and I think we're going to put on sufficient evidence to demonstrate that Derek Chauvin intended to kill George Floyd. Incidentally, as a human being, I think that Derek Chauvin intended to kill George Floyd, right? That is my personal opinion. That is not, you know, a legal analysis or the position of, you know, Clean Up on Aisle 45 institutionally as a podcast. But right, he knelt on the guy's neck for 9 minutes. That seems pretty clear to me. But look, as a prosecutor, you never know what a jury is going to think at the end of the day.
Yeah, but you don't have to file all those charges, right? You can just say second degree murder and the jury might come back with third degree murder. You don't have to have it filed, do you? Or do you? Because then do you just file everything underneath it?
Yeah, no, you do have to file those additional charges, right?
Okay. Like,
so yeah, it is. And that's why you include the lesser included offenses. And so if the jury returns a guilty verdict on murder in the second degree, then he'll be sentenced under the second degree murder statute, which contains a maximum punishment of imprisonment for not more than 40 years. Third degree murder carries a maximum penalty of imprisonment for not more than 25 years. If you don't have the third degree murder charge in there and the jury says, well, we're hung, right? We're divided over whether it was intentional or not, right? Then you could be left with a situation where Chauvin, where the only charge upon which the jury returns a sufficient factual basis to convict would be manslaughter. And I think that would not be good for the city of Minneapolis if that were to happen.
Right. Okay. Well, that makes sense. Well, I mean, none of this makes sense, but this, you know, the, what you've explained makes sense so far. And we'll keep our eye on it for you. This is, we'll put a pin in it. Is that what you say, Andrew?
Yeah.
All right. Well, everybody stay with us because right after this break, I've got some information about Cock. You don't want to miss it. Stay with us. Hey, everybody, it's AG, and this episode of Clean Up on Aisle 45 is brought to you by BetterHelp. Life can be very stressful, and there's a lot of anxiety. It can be unpredictable. And when life throws a curveball at you, just remember, you don't have to face it alone. So if you're struggling with anything that's preventing you from living your happiest life, I recommend BetterHelp. BetterHelp provides professional counseling to help you navigate life's challenges, and it's not self-help. It's not a crisis line. It's actual professional counseling done securely online. They'll assess your needs, and then they'll match you with your own licensed professional therapist who you can start communicating with in fewer than 24 hours. You know, I've had my own challenges with anxiety and PTSD, and I know how important it is to seek help rather than to try to face it alone. The great thing is that BetterHelp services are available for clients worldwide, and you can log into your account anytime from anywhere and send a message to your counselor, and you'll get timely, thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches too, so they make it free and easy to change your counselor if you want to. And it's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is always available. So visit their website and read some testimonials like BetterHelp user CA, who says, Dr. Black is an excellent listener and doesn't give up on her clients. She works with her clients to keep up with solutions that they might not have thought up on their own. So visit BetterHelp.com/cleanup. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, and you can join the over 800,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. Special offer for Cleanup on Aisle 45 listeners. Get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/cleanup. All right, everybody. Welcome back to Clean Up on Aisle 45. I'd like to take a trip down memory lane. Do you remember a long time ago during the Mueller investigation when charges were brought against Manafort for tax and business fraud, but also for bribery? He had a buddy who worked at a bank that was supposed to just be for veterans, by the way. It was a lending bank. And that guy's name was Stephen M. Cock. He worked for that FDIC-regulated Federal Savings Bank. And he basically lent, that bank lent Manafort a quarter of its balance sheet. And in exchange, Manafort says, hey, man, actually, Cock asked him, hey, man, can you make me the Secretary of the Army? And apparently Manafort put that request in. And those charges were brought against Manafort, and we all remember the Manafort trials. And however, when Manafort was convicted, he was convicted on, I believe, 18 counts, or he was brought up on 18 counts, convicted on 9. One of the counts, I can't remember how many he eventually went down for. It was a lot. But one of the counts, multiple accounts, the jury was hung on several of these accounts. And the bribery charge is one of the counts that the rural juror didn't think Manafort was guilty of. So that was a hung conviction. Well, now, as of now, believe it or not, this is coming back again. There is now a superseding indictment on Cock. And this is for, let's see, what did they charge him with? Count two, adding count two, conspiracy to commit financial institution bribery, citing a January 10th, 2017 interview for Undersecretary of the Army at Presidential Transition Team's Manhattan offices. So that is now a superseding indictment being added to Cock's charges. And this is kind of reminiscent of a few other things that we've seen with superseding indictments that have come down the pike. But Manafort, I kind of am wondering now where Manafort stands on this, because he was never convicted and never he stood trial for this count, but he was never convicted of it, never served any time. Not sure then that that falls under the pardon, nor am I sure that it falls under double jeopardy provisions that may exist in the Southern District of New York, which is, as you know, Andrew, why Manafort couldn't be brought up on business and tax charges at the state level, even though Cuomo signed a law saying, you know, the double jeopardy doesn't count in instances of when they're pardoned. He was signed that too late for it to count for the Manafort tax and business charges to be filed at the state level. But now I'm wondering if this bribery, financial bribery charge, can't be brought by New York State, even though it occurred in Chicago. But I think that the bribery conversation took place in New York. So what are your thoughts, having seen the verbiage of the Manafort pardon? Can Manafort be either brought up on federal or state charges for this bribery count now that he never served time for or was convicted of?
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think that that there are two things that have sort of combined here with respect to Manafort that are probably going to place him beyond the reach of subsequent prosecution. Right. So the first is the text of the Manafort pardon includes a full pardon for any crimes in connection with the Mueller investigation. So
that erases federal crime,
right.
Federal charges.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the problem is that in state court, we've had a ruling in February from the New York Court of Appeals that said that Cy Vance violated the state's double jeopardy law by attempting to charge Paul Manafort with mortgage fraud and other felonies. And they would be duplicative. And again, I thought that Vance had a decent argument here. Without kind of delving too deeply into the dual sovereigns doctrine. but I thought Vance, took an aggressive position. I thought he had a decent argument. And the problem is that the Court of Appeals, New York State Supreme Court, one-page ruling, did not opine on the merits, but just said we are going to leave in place an order that says it violates double jeopardy to charge Manafort on a state level for crimes that he'd already been pardoned for at the federal level. And I think any court looking at that order is going to apply it in the same way to efforts to resuscitate this.
So it's not so much about the specific crimes he committed or the specific behaviors that led to the crimes. Because with Cy Vance, he was trying to charge him with tax and mortgage
yep.
fraud, right? Now, Manafort had not been tried and convicted for mortgage fraud in the federal
correct.
Trial, but they said because he was pardoned for things stemming from the Mueller investigation and that stemmed from the Mueller investigation,
exactly right.
It would be double jeopardy?
That's exactly
okay,
right.
Okay, so then any crime, whether he's been charged, tried, or convicted or not, that came out of the Mueller investigation, it appears that the Manafort will not be able to be charged at the state level for any crime
yep. Manafort,
that came out of the
right,
Mueller investigation.
Who has defrauded the United States out of nine figures of tax income, who is truly one of the most deplorable scumbags in the country today. Yeah, he's, you know, untouchable on anything in connection with the Mueller report. Now, and the Mueller investigation. Now, look, like, I, again, this is beans here, but I'd put all my beans that Manafort has committed additional crimes. So, you know, I would be out there, keeping a watchful eye to see, you know, what additional crimes there are. But sadly, this is not going to be a vehicle to get Manafort back into court. And it leaves us with this situation that we saw, you know, in the Michael Flynn and Bijan Kian case, where, you know, the principal instigator, the person who arranged, because let's, you know, not pass too lightly over what Stephen Kwok did. Stephen Kwok used his power at the bank to arrange for $16 million in high-risk loans to Paul Manafort. As you said, a third of the bank's balance sheet absolutely should not have been lent. And the consideration was Manafort was going to, you know, buddy up to Trump and, you know, get Kwok appointed Undersecretary of the Army. And as ridiculous as that sounds, like, that's not more ridiculous than the MyPillow guy planning your legal strategy. So, you know, who knows?
No, not undersecretary. Full fucking Secretary of the Army. He wanted to be Secretary of the Army.
That's, yeah.
Now, could they take a crack at it in Chicago, in Illinois state? I don't know what their sovereignty laws are, because, well, here's the thing. The default is for the United States that it is not double jeopardy to try someone for state crimes if they've been convicted for federal crimes, right? Many states, though, take the step to say that that does violate sovereignty, and like New York was one of them, and that's why Cuomo signed that law saying, except in the case of presidential pardons, but that was too late for the Manafort stuff. I don't know what the disposition is of sovereignty, the double jeopardy stuff over in Illinois. Can they take a crack at it in Chicago, where the bank is?
Yeah, and so I'm going to have to give you an I don't know on that. I will tell you that the baseline is exactly as you've described it, right? Which is that double jeopardy applies to being prosecuted for the same offense against the same sovereign twice, right? And so, in other words, it does not, in the abstract, offend double jeopardy to have a state prosecution for a crime for which you have been pardoned at the federal level. I will tell you, Illinois has a Double Jeopardy Act, but whether that would cover Manafort in this precise situation, you know, I mean, I'd have to delve into that. It's worth looking at.
Okay. So on in the same sovereign, hence the dual sovereignty.
Right. Yeah. Because exactly. Illinois is also a sovereign, right? And so the way in which, right, if you are a good originalist like our Supreme Court, you know, like 5/9 of our Supreme Court, you would say, right, how can the sovereign of the United States infringe on the sovereignty of the state of Illinois to prosecute offenses against it, right? Like, where does that power come from in the Constitution? And by the way, like, every founding father would line up behind, you know, you and me on that one, and not, you know, not Paul Manafort. But, you know, it remains to be seen how that would play out in the court. And, you know, I doubt that there is a lot of interest in wanting to go after Manafort in Chicago, but who knows? You know, it just takes one ambitious prosecutor somewhere.
Yeah. My only concern is that if it can't be anything that was found during the Mueller investigation, I'm hard pressed to think of what Mueller might have missed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he was pretty thorough.
Yep. I mean, look, we still have, and
it'd be interesting too, though, because we don't have. Sorry to interrupt, but we don't have those underlying documents. All we have is what's in the Mueller report. We don't have the grand jury materials. So, if some prosecutor actually brought charges in New York State against something Manafort did that we never heard about, that only the grand jury ever heard about, somebody would have to object and file a motion saying, "No, Mueller looked into that. You just didn't know about it."
Yeah. And you just hit on the two points that I was going to make, which are, number one, presumably right now, the Biden DOJ is looking at all of the ancillary Mueller report materials and determining what they can declassify and release to the public. We're entitled to the public fruits of that, right?
Right.
And we will get that. And secondly, right, as a subset, right, we have the investigations that were handed off, that were truncated, right? Like, there are a lot of things in connection with the Mueller report where, you know, we had to guess under redactions, and
we did. We spent a lot of time doing that.
I know. And again, you know, the Biden administration now at least knows what's under those redactions.
Yeah, a lot of them were revealed actually thanks to BuzzFeed and their FOIA requests, and good old Judge Reggie Walton.
My hero.
Who was like, you know, I don't know that these redactions were made properly or appropriately. I'm going to have somebody review these to see if they're actually for privacy purposes. And there were tons of redactions that had to be revealed in that court case specifically, in that FOIA case from BuzzFeed. God bless Jason Leopold, you know?
And just one last note. I pulled up the text of the Illinois Double Jeopardy Act, which says, whenever on the trial of an accused person for the violation of any criminal law of the state, it is shown that he has previously been tried and convicted or acquitted under the laws of the federal government, which former trial was based on the act of remission, which is being tried in this state, it is a sufficient defense. So
he wasn't convicted.
Yeah,
there's an and, not an or.
That's right. And so, you know, could that have been expansively interpreted in the case law as including offenses for which you were pardoned? That's a possibility. So, you know, it's why I've hedged my bets there a little bit. But it doesn't seem on face that that would bar a subsequent prosecution.
Yeah, there would just be a jurisdictional question as to whether or not you could charge Manafort in Chicago for that bribe.
Exactly right.
Because you can charge Koch because that's where his bank is.
Indeed.
But he's being charged in Southern District. And in fact, Koch came back and argued, hey, I think it'd be easier to do this in Chicago. And they're like, nah, we're going to keep it in Southern District.
Yeah. Yeah.
So interesting, fascinating. We will, again, keep our ears open for all things Koch. This show.
I'm 12.
Yeah, dude, so many jokes. I remember when the reason we learned about the Koch bribery scheme in the first place was because his wife filed for divorce. And as you know, divorce proceedings are public.
Uh-huh.
And so it all came out in the divorce. But because before that, they weren't letting that information out. Right. We had said they were being cock blocked. But
what a strange, delusional little man. But you know,
I'm gonna be Secretary of the Army. Here's $16 million, a quarter. It was between a quarter and a third of my bank's money. Here you go. Here, have it. And what did he need it for? You know, when you think about it, because he was also being sued previously by Oleg Deripaska.
Yep.
For $14 million for a telecommunications scam gone wrong in Ukraine. So, good times.
Good. I don't know that I could say it any better than that.
All right, cool. Everybody, you want to stick around because we are going to talk with the incomparable, often imitated, never duplicated Asha Rangappa right after this message. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, everyone. It's AG for Cleanup on Aisle 45. Do you ever listen to Andrew and I and you start shouting at your radio or into the void because you want to ask us a question or tell us something, make a correction? Well, you can now. We go live on the Stereo app where you can ask us questions directly. So join us for the Cleanup on Aisle 45 after party Q&A for uncensored opinions, exclusive content. You get to hear Andrew say swear words, and it's only available on the Stereo app. I love Stereo. I'm on the app talking all the time. You can follow me at Allison Gill and get notified every time I go live. We take a deep dive into a variety of topics, and we interact directly with you. Download the Stereo app and follow us at stereo.com/AllisonGill. There's a link in the description of the show, and then you can join us over on the Stereo app. Stereo app has thousands of live social conversations with a wide range of genres for every interest, including news, comedy, sports, and more. Andrew and I go live every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 Eastern. And what's great about this is you can choose whether you want to be a co-host, participate as a guest, or just listen in on exclusive conversations. So we'll see you for the Cleanup on Aisle 45 After Party every Tuesday at 5 Pacific, 8 Eastern. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. We are fortunate and honored to be joined by the incredible former FBI agent and lawyer and amazing person, Asha Rangappa. Asha, welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, this is going to be an amazing conversation because last week, before the FBI member, you know, a representative from the FBI testified before the Joint Senate Committee about the insurrection, we had Andrew McCabe on, and he had some insights as to what might be asked, and that's basically how it went. And I was wondering what your top line thoughts were about the FBI response and the subsequent testimony from the counterterrorism expert at the FBI.
So I think I personally was a little underwhelmed by the FBI testimony. I thought it was fine. I don't think that there was, you know, a smoking gun, that they did anything crazy wrong. But I think it highlighted that this was not elevated in the way that one might expect, given all of the red flags that we were seeing in public view.
In that Sund testified that he didn't even get the information, right?
Yeah. So we have first, you know, this Norfolk memo, which I think was, there's a little bit too much attention on that front. But in any case, so that went out, it went out kind of through, you know, according to normal protocol. But the point is that even when it was disseminated to the Joint Terrorism Task Force or communicated in these other ways, whoever's eyeballs were going over this did not seem to think that it warranted, you know, a code red, DEFCON 5 kind of situation. And so, you know, I think that's the question. Like, why not? Right?
Yeah.
If this had been an unvetted and raw intelligence report that, you know, hundreds of Muslims were descending on DC and intended to create war and, you know, whatever the language was, I bet it would have been flagged. And there would have been additional steps beyond the normal protocol that would have been taken. And so, you know, my friend and colleague, Frank Figluzzi, wrote a great op-ed for NBC that basically called out the white elephant in the room, which is that, you know, it seems like there was some implicit bias going on here in terms of reviewing this. And I think that that does need to be addressed, even if the FBI did everything by the book. Sometimes you need to go beyond the book. And the question is, why didn't they hear?
Yeah. And especially when we heard from General William Walker that it took seconds to get approval during the Black Lives Matter protests, not just in June, but in July and in August and in September, just seconds to go up and down that chain of command. Six, I think, approvals were needed to deploy the National Guard. And then there were other clues that they had the intelligence in that Sund requested an emergency authorization 2 days before the insurrection, and Irving and Stenger wouldn't put their names on that, and so it was declined by the board of governors at the Capitol Police, or whatever that board is there for. And then also something that you tweeted, that National Guard, some of the folks were saying that the National Guard, the optics would be bad because they could potentially incite the mob into violence after the violence was already occurring. But as you said, doesn't that indicate that they thought they were a dangerous mob?
Right. So let's tease out a couple of things. When we talk about the FBI and what they knew, we're looking at what was happening proactively, right? Like, what did they know ahead of time? How were they preparing for this? And so I think that that's one area which needs to be examined. And I think that the FBI plays a big role there. Then there's the reactive component, which is the crazy has started. Okay, whatever you did and didn't do beforehand, we now know the crazy has started. You're getting these frantic calls for help. I don't know where optics comes into that, A of all. So we'll come back to the optics piece. But then B, the rationale that sending in reinforcement is going to incite these people. I don't even know where to begin to process that. Like, since when, you know, I mean, do police not, you know, go and bust the drug deal because their presence might incite the drug dealers? You know, do we not go in and, I mean,
no.
Yes, people who are committing crimes often get angry when law enforcement shows up. It kind of goes with the territory, but you know what? We do it anyway.
Wait, have you been trained for that at all? I mean, is there any kind of, you know, has Quantico picked up on that?
But I think to the tweet that you're referring to, what I was getting to is that there is also a deeper implication there when they are saying, oh, this will incite them, that they kind of understood the frame of mind that this crowd was in. It wasn't a shock. They knew that these people were angry people who might become even further emboldened if they see, you know, people coming in to stop them. And so, again, that then raises the question of, well, if you knew that about these people, then why wasn't there more on the proactive side happening? If you already, you know, kind of understood this about the character of this group. And then there's that optics piece, which to me tells me everything, which is you know, and I explained this on CNN too, what I hear is we don't want to make it look like these people deserve the same response as the Black Lives Matter people. Mm. And why not? Because it was very important that the existential threat be Antifa, right? Antifa was, you know, hide your wife, hide your kids, you know, like they're so dangerous. But if you send in the same kind of response to the supporters of the president, then you are basically equating them. And I mean, and that's to me the optics that they were trying to avoid. Do you have another interpretation? Because that's my interpretation.
No. And then also blaming BLM for their lack of response, I think, is extremely disingenuous.
Well, so there's two things happening here, right? I mean, we saw this in the hearings, so that they want to equate January 6th with BLM. So then why aren't you also demanding that there was the same response? Like, in other words, if they are the same, and I don't think they were the same, but if they are the same, then why wasn't there the same response? Like, why aren't you as outraged that there wasn't the same kind of, you know, law enforcement reaction and presence?
Yeah. And I was wondering, Andrew, because we were talking about the news that has come out in the last 24 hours about a widening of the investigation into the communications. Andrew, what was that piece about?
Yeah, and Asha, what insight do you have into the ongoing inquiry as to whether there were communications between various congressional staffers and those folks who were involved with the 1-6 insurrection, which, you know, really seems to cast some of the earlier responses into a sharper light?
Yeah. You know, it's starting to look a lot like collusion. That's kind of like always a tune that comes into my head, right?
No collusion. No collusion.
My favorite is when Asha's like, at the FBI, that's what we call a clue.
So I have said for a while that the initial, because at first there were a lot of questions of why are they only charging these people with such low-level crimes? It's because that's all they have right now. Like, obviously, trespassing is very obvious from a photo, but they need time to gather additional evidence for more things. And as they gather things like communications between people, then they can start to create evidence that may support charges for example, conspiracy. Okay. Conspiracy is an agreement to commit a crime. Now, I'm not saying that these people, whoever they're investigating in Congress, are necessarily guilty of that, but that's where that could go. If they were in communication, you establish that, you know, they know each other. There's contact that's happening. And then in terms of what did they know? What were they doing in those communications? And were they kind of facilitating, encouraging, or in any way a part of it? And especially if there's communications before, right? Leading up to this, not just during. So, I think that some of these members of Congress should be worried. You know, if they have those communications records, it means that they are relevant to an investigation. I mean, the FBI cannot go on some kind of fishing expedition for them to subpoena these kind of communications records. They need an ongoing investigation and need to show that these records are relevant to it. So there is a connection somehow. And I don't know what else there is to say about this. Some of these members of Congress were incredibly concerned, it seemed like, during the hearings about what the FBI could get.
Yeah, almost that whole, like, if you're a cop, you have to tell me, right? Okay, Josh Hawley.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that certainly caught AG and my attention were the incredibly light charges against one of the zip tie guys that played out. And as you know, we were thinking at the time, you know, it was sort of difficult to figure out what kind of, you know, cooperative information he might have that would be of use in an investigation. Obviously, entirely speculative here, but it does seem like the pieces are falling into place to think that that the investigation is widening in scope. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yes, I do. And like you said, I can't speculate on any individual person, but when the FBI arrests someone, they are going to threaten them with everything they possibly can. And what they, you know, we could get you for this and that and the other. You know, if you want to cooperate and give us any information, then we can see what we can do. And so it's in the interest of the person, depending on what they're looking at, to cough up information, perhaps, you know, voluntarily cough up things like emails and phone records or whatever they have. You know, look, the alternative is maybe the FBI just doesn't have any more, right? And so if all they can charge you with, that's a possibility. So I think it will really depend on the individual and what evidence they're able to gather. But yes, if, you know, I mean, Zip Tie Guy, he came in there prepared for a mission. So, you know, he wasn't just like a rando who wandered into the Capitol because it looked cool and everybody else was doing it, in which case you could see like a low-level offense of some kind of misdemeanor or something like that. That guy looked like he had some preparation, you know, before it and knew what was going to go down that day. So, you know, my gut would tell me that he might have more information to provide on, you know, what went into the planning for that day.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit more on conspiracy? Because in my experience, I'm sort of struggling to bring the events of 1/6 under, you know, sort of typical conspiracy analysis, because, you know, you have thousands of participants, right? And so do you envision in a case like that they would be bringing, you know, sort of a subset of folks among whom, you know, it would be easier to show, you know, an agreement? I mean, obviously,
yeah, look,
you know, you have an underlying cause. Yeah,
we can look at the video that day, and it's clear that, I mean, there were hundreds of people, not all of these hundreds of people were like involved in the conspiracy. Okay. And I think Director Ray broke it down that there was a huge contingent of people who came, they were at the rally, and apparently didn't make it over to the Capitol. Okay, did not commit a crime, were there, you know, for First Amendment purposes. Then there are a bunch of people who were a part of the mob mentality, went in. They may have trespassed, there may be vandalism, there may be, you know, but it could be a not planned but spur of the moment kind of thing. But then he did specify that there were a group of people that, you know, had a plan. And so, you know, I think it's important, like, it can be both true that there was a conspiracy, but that not everybody that we saw that day was in on the conspiracy, right? And so I think the most serious charges will be about those people. And we saw some evidence. These are the people who came with the tactical gear, who had the earpieces, you know, maps. I mean, obviously, like I said, had a mission that day, which seems to suggest that there had been planning and forethought involved.
Yeah, and they had meetup points in different states, in Raleigh, et cetera. And then finally, I was really curious about the mechanics of the investigatory process, specifically with regards to the telephone communications or cell phone communications, because there were a lot of Republican senators kvetching about FISA and illegal surveillance, and it seemed to me they wanted to draw some sort of a parallel between, you know, getting geolocation information, subpoenaing phone records, you know, going through the actual process of that the FBI is known to go through, versus warrants and FISA and pen registers and all these other kinds of things that absolutely don't play a role at all.
Yeah. So FISA stands for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance
Act. I'm sorry, what's the first word?
Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Well, Ted Cruz is Canadian.
I have no idea what they could possibly have to do with 1-6, unless, you know, there were, like, you know, foreign intelligence agents that were involved, but, you know, that would not implicate, you know,
Ted Cruz is Canadian.
Right. Well, so, you know, we know that they've created a Pavlovian response when they say FISA, right? Like, everybody's head, you know, their base's head explodes. It would have nothing to do with what happened on January 6th, at least from what I can surmise, right? Any kind of communications information that the FBI would obtain related to 1-6 would be part of a criminal investigation that would have, I think, by definition, been opened after the crime occurred, what? Right? Like, you know, this is a minority report. They weren't doing pre-crime. Like, they, apparently they didn't do pre-crime. They didn't, like, stop anything. So,
come on, Asha. CNN knew the night before. Oh, wait, that was Roger Stone. I'm sorry.
So, you know, so they would be using criminal, investigative techniques. They would be getting subpoenas. You know, pen register is a list of phone numbers called to and from. So that could be something that they could get as well, but has nothing to do with FISA.
Yeah.
The criminal investigations are separate from national security investigations, and FISA would have nothing to do with it on that side.
And I think it's worth pointing out that the standard under which those subpoenas would be issued in connection with 1-6 is a higher standard than the FISA standard.
Thank you. Yes, it's a higher standard. You would have to show that they are relevant to an ongoing investigation. And I think, you know, Alison and I were talking before that it seems like there is both an attempt to trigger the Pavlovian response to the word FISA, but also to somehow muddy the waters and suggest that if the FBI gets information, that they were, you know, surveilling the people at the rally beforehand. They weren't, I assure you, right? I mean, like I said, unless they would need, there would have to be a completely different aspect to what was going on that we don't know about. Like I said, like some foreign intelligence presence or something like that for some kind of ongoing surveillance to be going on. Even then, it would be like such a minefield internally in terms of regulations and stuff that I couldn't even imagine. So, but I think that's what they're trying to do is blur this line and to kind of preemptively discredit. I mean, don't you think that's kind of what I was hearing?
100% what they're going for the FBI deep state.
A way to preemptively discredit what would be an ordinary criminal investigation.
Well, Asha, I appreciate you coming on today. I hope we have you back soon. Thank you so much. And tell everyone where they can find you and your work, because you're one of the best follows on Twitter.
Absolutely.
Oh, thank you. Yes, you can follow me on Twitter at Asha Rangappa _. You can also check out my website that has some of my clips and recent op-eds, www.asharangappa.com.
Well, awesome. It's been wonderful to see you again. Everybody, stick around. We'll be right back right after this. Hey everyone, it's AG for Cleanup on Aisle 45. It's March already, and we're already more than a week into it. That's so great. Spring has sprung. It's time for spring cleaning and getting the house in order. You can get a great head start by revisiting your home and auto insurance policies by using Policy Genius. Policy Genius can help you kill two birds with one stone, or as my mom says, set two birds free with one key. You can compare home and auto insurance rates, and you can save up to $1,055 a year by reshopping. That's money you can put towards things that you really care about. And here's how it works. First, you go to PolicyGenius.com, answer a few quick questions about yourself and your property. Then Policy Genius will take it from there. They do all the heavy lifting. They'll compare rates for over 30 top insurers, from Progressive to Nationwide, and they will find you the lowest rates. The Policy Genius team will look at all the ways to maximize your savings, including bundling your home and auto policies, for example. And if Policy Genius finds a better rate than what you're paying now, they'll switch you over for free. It is free to do all this. You might as well check. It is no wonder with that level of service, Policy Genius has earned a 5-star rating across over 1,600 reviews at Trustpilot and Google. So if you're worried that this year is flying by and you've barely gotten anything done, take a deep breath. Policy Genius will help make the most of this short month in minutes. Just reshop your home and auto insurance, and you could save up to $1,055. So head to policygenius.com to get started right now. Policy Genius. When it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right. Everybody, welcome back. It is time for the favorite segment by, I think, Andrew, this is yours, it's mine, and many listeners absolutely love this segment, the Goodbye to You segment. And now, here we go. Goodbye to you. We have some fun ones today. On Friday, President Biden fired Sharon Gustafson, clearly some sort of weird evil spawn of GSA Emily, who was appointed by former President Trump as the general counsel of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Very important job, by the way. She was asked to resign, but respectfully declined the request, claiming that there are those who oppose my advocacy on behalf of employees who experience religious discrimination and on behalf of constitutional and statutory protections for religious entities.
Yeah, this is a person who looks at the entirety of discrimination in employment in the United States of America and comes away with, won't someone please think of the Christians? Yeah, it will not.
The poor white businessman Christians. Come
on.
It
will not surprise you to learn that she is, of course, a member of the Federalist Society.
No.
Yeah. Was the keynote speaker for the National Faith at Work Conference. And that is, and I swear I am not making any of this up, quote, a national convening point for workplace chaplains. End of quote.
God. That reminds me of, remember Freedom Fest? Freedom Fest! Pew, pew, pew!
Is that Freedom Rock, man?
Mm-hmm. Turn it up, man.
Oh, gosh.
Now, why this matters to me is she's used to the belief that religion belongs in the workplace as a club against LGBTQ plus folks while at the EEOC. Her signature accomplishment, if you want to call it that, was that the EEOC sued Kroger, the grocery store company, after employees complained that wearing aprons that had a rainbow-colored heart on them violated their religious belief, as the employees believed the emblem endorsed LGBTQ plus values.
Yeah, and here is the double standard. For Gustafson, it's perfectly okay for Hobby Lobby to get an exemption to all the laws ever because the corporation somehow has Christian beliefs. But for Kroger, whose website has a separate page for Kroger Pride, right, that says that they are a company that, quote, embraces diversity and inclusion as core values, they tout their perfect score on the Human Rights Campaign's equality index, right? Like, it in all aspects, if Hobby Lobby has the right to hold conservative evangelical beliefs as an institution, I don't see how you can then simultaneously say it's wrong for Kroger to hold liberal inclusive beliefs, right? But they deliberately sued. I mean, the EEOC didn't just send like a letter and say they took Kroger to court on behalf of the employees who said wearing a heart with a rainbow on it violates my religious rights.
But having a stage shaped like a Nazi symbol.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. We won't go there. Anyway, you know, hey, that's awful. But good news.
Oh,
she's gone.
Good. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And AG, you're really, really going to love this one. Guess who has white nationalist asshole Stephen Miller's old office at the White House?
Please tell me it's a woman of color. Please tell me it's a
not
woman
just
of color.
Any woman of color. It is frequent right-wing punching bag Susan Rice.
Yes.
The former national security advisor under Obama, new Biden director of White House Domestic Policy Council.
One of the architects of the Russia hoax,
God.
Right?
So, I love the Schadenfreude there, but you're really gonna love this one. She has taken to as being reported by the New York Times, burning sage in the office, which is associated with rituals by indigenous peoples in ceremonies, quote, meant to cleanse spaces from negativity and to promote healing. So good for her. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, my dad is for most of his adult life worked for McCormick's, the spice company. He was in their IT department, and so when he retired, they give you a little custom spice jar, and my dad's custom spice jar was sage. So, I love that. Love the healing. Ms. Rice has also hung a painting made by a Haitian artist that depicts a group of black individuals in colorful clothing walking down the street. So, you know.
Well, I love it. Bye-bye, Stephen Miller. Bye-bye.
Oh, yeah. Can't have enough. Goodbye to you.
Mm. I wonder if there was, like, spray-on hair stuck to the carpet, you know.
God.
Just in a stencil outline in the shape of Stephen Miller.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's such great poetic justice that Susan Rice now occupies his office.
That.
And it kind of reminds me of when, and they did this quickly too, when Biden walked into the White House with Dr. Jill Biden for the first time, and all of the pictures had changed. The Andrew Jackson came down and Ben Franklin went up. Like just all of everything had been probably deep cleaned and sanitized. And then they came in and just whoo, really quick, took down all of the horrible decorative choices, I guess you could call, that the former guy made. And that night he did a little speech from the Resolute desk, which was sans a Diet Coke button.
I was going to mention the Diet Coke button.
Sorry, I took that away from you.
That's the one thing that, like, because I used to have, you know, back when I worked for the big firm and before I, you know, decided to go it out on my own, I had this, you know, nice kind of man cave basement, and I had a wet bar and I had a soda gun. And so I would have Diet Coke on tap, and beer on tap, of course, in my basement. So, it was not a Diet Coke button, a little, you know, like Harvey Villachez did not come out with a silver tray with a Diet Coke on it. But I could get fountain Diet Coke whenever I wanted. And it is, I do not miss the big firm life, but I do miss my Diet Coke dispenser. So
nice Fantasy Island. Callback there with the Harvey Villachez.
We've done a couple this show, so.
Now, Merrick Garland vote should be happening today, Wednesday, as this episode airs. What do you suspect the timeline is? Because I'm waiting for the wave of U.S. attorneys. I know we've seen trickles here and there of them resigning, leaving their offices. They were supposed to be out by last Tuesday. Maybe we just haven't heard about it. But what do you suppose the timeline is for putting new U.S. attorneys in those positions?
I expect that under Merrick Garland that the DOJ will move quickly. We know that there's a pretty deep bench. We know that. That Biden has been really proactive about talking to local folks to find, you know, the kind of talent to replace the folks that they're rooting out. And I agree with you, right? Like there's some level of continuity and transition that you need, even as you're phasing out, you know, 50 plus former Trumpers. And we have not seen, right? Like Gustafson wrote a defiant letter, right? Said, I am not, definitely not resigning. We have not seen kind of similar defiant letters from the rest of the U.S. attorneys. So I suspect we're going to see those waves coming, you know, relatively quickly, and we'll cover it here on Goodbye to You.
I think they'll all be seated by end of April, latest. I have not heard mum's the word on anyone throwing their hats in.
Yeah.
Particularly for the biggins, like D.C., Southern District. I'm Eastern District. I'm very Eastern District of Virginia. Very interested to know who's even applied. And it's incredible that we haven't heard anything about that yet, unless they aren't taking applications yet. But that can't be the case.
Yeah. No, I agree with you on both parts of that. And I would be very curious. No one's asked me. So, well, you know, that we can rule me out. But other than that,
yeah, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't. But maybe I can get Sidney Powell's old job.
We could spot Sidney Powell 150 questions on the bar exam, and I would still take your score over hers. So
thank you. Well, this has been a great show. Thanks again to Asha Rangappa for joining us, explaining that stuff to us. and the goodbye to you segment is just, it's so wonderful. This Susan Rice story, I'm just going to be walking around my house smiling for the rest of the day. Maybe I'll burn some sage in honor of Stephen Miller being gone, even though he wasn't in my home. But anyway, Andrew, thanks so much. This has been great.
Yeah, thank you. Always, it's a pleasure.
All right, everybody, we will see you next week on Clean Up on Aisle 45.
Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres and is engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mizell and Starburns Audio. Fact-checking and research by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres with quality assurance and media by Muller She Wrote LLC. Branding, design, and logo by Starburns Audio and Joel Reeder with Moxie Design Studios. And our copy is written by Jesse Egan. Our music is written and recorded by Adam Orr and Christopher Hoffey, and our opening sequence was designed by Allison Gill and mixed by Mackenzie Mizell and Starburns Audio. Follow us on Twitter at Aisle45Pod and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't miss our cleanup on Aisle 45 After Party on the Stereo app. We'll be going live every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 Eastern, and we want to hear from you. Our first stereo show went a little bit like this.
Quick question. I was wondering if you could take a deeper dive into Trump Chicago. What exactly is going on there?
Oh, I know.
The lender just let him off the hook for $100 million. There's so much out there. I'm just a little confused of exactly what the risk is here for him. Thanks a lot. Ooh. Bye.
I think I know. I'm going to try this, and then Andrew, you tell me if I'm right.
Okay.
Okay. So basically, this institution lent Donald about $100 million to $130 million for Trump Tower Chicago, and in the middle of the financial housing crisis, when real estate sucked butts, they made a deal saying, hey, I'll give you $45 million if you, you know, forgive $100 million of the debt. Because with, you know, all of the interest accrual and everything, it was about up to $150 million. So the lender was like, $45 million is better than zero, even though Trump claims to have billions of dollars. $45 million is better than zero. Cool. We'll go ahead and forgive, not cancel, forgive $100 million of this debt. Now, the IRS requires you to take a forgiven debt as income and pay appropriate taxes on it. If you have it now, the New York Times, when they did their expose tax story on Donald Trump, it showed that Donald put that down as a canceled debt, which allows you to take the hit on income spread over multiple years. And so what the Manhattan DA is looking at in this particular instance is, I mean, any financial institution can forgive a debt if they feel like it, right? They cut a deal with Trump. I don't know that he ever paid that $45 million, but in any case, the debt was forgiven. And so what they're looking at specifically is whether or not Trump legally called it income, or, you know, called it a forgiven debt and paid income taxes on it. And so that's what they're looking into in that particular little thing. I think the Seven Springs Estate stuff is going to be the albatross, but that's what that particular thing that they're looking at is.
That is 100% correct. I have literally nothing to add to that.
Woohoo!
Stereo is the app for live social conversations, and we want to talk directly with you, the listeners. You can join our show, ask questions about news, politics, comedy, anything, anything you want. You can sing us a song if you feel like it. You can share your experiences and opinions. We want to hear everything. So download now. Join us live this week, Tuesday at 5 Pacific, 8 Eastern. A link to our show is in the description. So join us over on the Stereo app.
Season 4 of How We Win is here.
For the past 4 years, we've been making history in critical elections all over the country. And last year, we made history again by expanding our majority in the Senate, beating election-denying Republicans in crucial state House races, and fighting back a non-existent red wave.
But the MAGA Republicans who plotted and pardoned the attempted overthrow of our government now control the House, thanks to gerrymandered maps and repressive anti-voter laws. And the chaotic spectacle we've already seen shows us just how far they will go to seize power, dismantle our government, and take away our freedoms.
So, the official podcast of The Persistence is back with Season 4. There's so much more important work ahead of us to fight for equity, justice, and our very democracy itself. We'll take you behind the lines and inside the rooms where it happens, with strategy and inspiration from progressive changemakers all over the country.
And we'll dig deep into the weekly news that matters most and what you can do about it. with messaging and communications expert, co-founder of Way to Win, and our new co-host, Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
So join Steve and I every Wednesday for your weekly dose of inspiration, action, and hope.
I'm Steve Pearson.
And I'm Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
And this is How We Win.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.